Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Patrick Woodall with the group Food and Water Watch, who assesses the threat to democratic governance revealed in the latest leaked text from the proposed Trans-Pacific Partnership Free Trade Agreement. Cassidy Sharp of Greenpeace USA, who discusses the broad coalition of environmental groups working to stop oil drilling in the Arctic. And Swarthmore College students George Woodliffe Stanley and Sarah Dobbs, who talk about the goals of their group's occupation of Swarthmore's Finance and Investment Office, calling for their college to divest from fossil fuels. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Former Conservative President Nicolas Sarkozy led his UMP party to the top spot in the second round of France's local elections, with National Front leader Marine Le Pen trailing behind. The unpopular socialists came in third. Socialist President François Hollande has fallen out of favor after he failed to make good on his campaign pledge to lower France's unemployment rate to below 10%. French pollster Bernard Sanan observed that the far-right anti-immigrant National Front did better than it did in 2011, but its progress has stalled. It seems to have reached a ceiling. These elections are seen as a test case ahead of 2017's presidential election. Many French pundits believe that the rise of the anti-immigrant National Front is a reflection of a new cultural insecurity among the French working class, while socialist orthodoxy has embraced new ethnic minorities. Laurent Bouvet, an advisor to the Socialist Party, told the London Observer, "The economic crisis, unemployment, social problems, and globalization make people afraid, but if it were just about economics, we would see these people voting for the radical left, which they are not." Hundreds of Mexican farm workers in Baja, California, 200 miles south of San Diego, have gone on strike for higher wages and better benefits. The workers, who pick produce for export to the United States, went on strike in mid-March and initially blocked roads, which drew nearly 1,000 police and army soldiers firing rubber bullets. Mexican farm workers in Baja make just $10 a day, are extremely poor, with many forced to live in homes without running water. Moreover, according to the Los Angeles Times, the devaluation of the Mexican peso against the U.S. dollar has increased the price of basic groceries and other daily necessities. Striking farm workers are demanding their wages double to $20 a day, plus overtime pay, and an end to routine sexual harassment of female workers. For years, growers have resisted any change. After days of negotiation, the Agricultural Council of Baja California offered a stingy 6% raise to striking workers. But smaller growers in Baja have already agreed to double the base pay they offer to farm workers. The state of Utah has adopted a housing-first approach to create residences for the chronically homeless, who often seek help in emergency shelters and hospitals. According to Mother Jones magazine, Utah has cut the number of homeless by 72% by finding apartments where the chronically homeless can live, no strings attached. For years, housing and services for the chronically homeless were conditioned on enrolling in drug rehabilitation programs and making a commitment to mental health counseling. But this approach has rarely worked. In the early 1990s, New York University psychologist Sam Tsemberis tried a radical new approach: just offer the chronically homeless permanent housing with access to counseling. The early program was a success, with nearly 90% of the formerly homeless remaining in their apartments at a much lower cost than providing emergency services to those living in the streets. When Tsemberis brought his approach to conservative Utah, he found allies, including the welfare director of the state's powerful Mormon church. Utah launched a program to eliminate chronic homelessness in the state by 2015 and committed to creating 2,000 apartment units for the homeless. The innovative program has come in under budget, costing one-third less than expected. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Leslie Rudden.
As President Obama seeks congressional approval for two controversial trade agreements, the Trans-Pacific Partnership and the European Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership, he must first win the battle for fast-track trade promotion authority in Congress. Fast-track is a mechanism created by former President Richard Nixon that would force Congress to vote on a trade agreement within 60 to 90 days after receiving it, with only limited debate and no amendments allowed. A vote on fast-track had come soon after Congress returns from its Easter recess on April 13th. But a recently leaked chapter of the 12-nation Trans-Pacific Partnership will likely provoke more opposition to the proposed free trade agreement. WikiLeaks and the New York Times published the previously secret TPP investment chapter on March 25th. That document reveals provisions that allow multinational corporations to challenge local, state, and federal public health, environmental, consumer, and labor laws, as well as court rulings, if a claim is made that they impinge on business profits. According to the document, complaints filed by corporations against government regulation would be adjudicated by tribunals organized under the World Bank or the United Nations. Your reporter spoke with Patrick Woodall, Research Director and Senior Policy Advocate with the group Food and Water Watch. Here he assesses the threat to democratic governance and extraordinary secrecy revealed in the latest leaked text from the proposed Trans-Pacific Partnership Free Trade Agreement.
TPP is basically NAFTA on steroids. It's 12 nations, Canada, the U.S., Mexico, Peru, Chile, New Zealand, Australia, Brunei, Malaysia, Singapore, Vietnam, and Japan. And it basically expands the NAFTA model throughout the Pacific Rim and carries some of the worst traits of NAFTA to a much broader audience. Especially concerning is actually some of the investment provisions, which we'll talk about in a second, but also that it is a joining agreement. That is, in the future, other countries, including maybe China, India, the Philippines, Indonesia, could plug right into this agreement. And so although we're negotiating it now with these 12 countries, other countries could come in that we're really not even anticipating.
One of the recent developments that's fueling the debate both on fast track and the larger issue of whether or not to approve the Trans-Pacific Partnership was the leak of a TPP secret investment chapter that was published by WikiLeaks and the New York Times. Tell us about the importance of this chapter, what it says, and the secrecy surrounding it.
Sure. The investment chapter is a vitally important portion of the trade deal. There are 24 chapters that cover all sorts of things, food safety, environmental regulations, and a host of other things. But the investment chapter is really the point of the spear for this kind of corporate-oriented trade agenda. It includes protections that allow companies to challenge state, federal, and even local laws that they claim have unfairly expropriated their anticipated profits. And this is kind of a huge new expansion of power for these companies, enabling them to kind of challenge as trade barriers for financial damages, very common sense public health, environmental, and consumer protections that we hold dear, that the U.S. public has fought for years to get into place, all of which a company could claim would be an expropriation of profits. This allows companies to do two things. One, they have a powerful weapon to prevent democracy in action by being able to sue for damages. And two, that has a tremendous chilling effect on the kind of laboratory of democracy that we see all across the country at the state houses and the city councils and in county and municipal government all over the country, where they're taking up issues that are important to their constituents and citizenry to protect them from kind of unnecessary abuses at the hands of some of these big businesses when the Congress is totally gridlocked. So it has a very chilling effect on this democracy in action that is terrible, basically. And many of the things, the kind of issues like states taking up efforts to ban or have moratoriums on fracking for natural gas, efforts to label GMO foods, all these things are liable to be challenged by foreign companies for damages as barriers to trade.
One thing that stunned me in reading a summary of this chapter is that even after this proposed Trans-Pacific Partnership came into effect, that this investment chapter would remain secret for 4 more years, which certainly puts this whole document in suspicion immediately. Tell us about the secrecy here.
So this is, of course, the most hyper-secret of the secrecy surrounding the TPP. The chapter contains a provision that would prevent the text from being shared even with the public until 4 years after the trade deal was either approved or had been rejected by the national governments, and basically keep this secret giveaway to big business on ice so that the kind of people that are really negotiating the deal, you know, in the U.S., there are 600 corporate trade advisors that are helping the U.S. trade representative negotiate the terms of the TPP with the other countries. Now, regular citizens like you and I are not privy to this information. Even the members of Congress are having difficulty accessing it. And on this chapter, we wouldn't even be able to see it, save for WikiLeaks. We wouldn't see it for 4 years after the trade deal was either nixed by the Congress or approved.
Tell our listeners about the coalition that's developed to oppose Fast Track and the Trans-Pacific Partnership. What are they doing to gear up for the Fast Track battle in Congress, which will be the first stop along the way if the Trans-Pacific Partnership is going to get an up or down vote later on?
So there's an incredibly broad-based national coalition that is already fighting Fast Track, but it is a coalition of labor, consumer, environmental, human rights, public health, international development, family, farm, and faith-based groups across the country and in all the other TPP countries that are concerned that this trade deal puts corporate interests ahead of the public interest.
That was Patrick Woodall, Research Director and Senior Policy Advocate with Food and Water Watch. Learn more about groups opposing Fast Track and the Trans-Pacific Partnership Free Trade Agreement by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Many environmental activists believe President Obama has been schizophrenic in his approach to climate change, calling for reductions in carbon pollution from vehicles and power plants on one hand, and on the other calling for an all-of-the-above energy strategy that includes massive exploitation of oil and gas. A similar pattern can be seen in the White House policy towards the Arctic, where Mr. Obama has called for protection of certain areas while allowing drilling for oil in others. Over the next 30 days, the U.S. Interior Department's Bureau of Ocean Energy Management will perform an environmental assessment of the Shell Oil Company's plan to drill for oil in the Arctic's Chukchi Sea, which is both rich in oil reserves and wildlife diversity. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with Cassidy Sharp, media officer with Greenpeace USA, the group which is leading a campaign to stop all oil drilling in the Arctic. She maintains that research has shown that if all recoverable oil using current technology were to be extracted from the entire Arctic region, not just in the U.S., it would provide just 5 years of oil supply to U.S. consumers at current rates. Here, Sharp discusses the coalition of groups that are fighting to stop oil drilling in the Arctic's pristine ecosystem, which are now accessible for drilling in many new areas due to global warming having opened up the frozen seas.
President Obama had protected the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, which Congress has to approve, and also protected 9.8 million acres of the Arctic Ocean, which seems like quite a lot, and we were very happy to hear that, as were other environmental organizations. However, a couple days later, also opened up several Gulf Coast and Atlantic seaboard drilling leases, and then also opened up major parts of the Arctic and the Alaskan Arctic to drilling as well. You can't really protect some parts of the Arctic and then open up other parts for drilling, because those paper boundaries are not going to stop wildlife from wandering into drilling spots.
What can President Obama do without Congress to protect the Arctic? Can he declare some or all of the Arctic seas that are part of U.S. territory to be a marine sanctuary with no drilling allowed?
So President Obama right now and his administration, they really have, and that includes the Department of the Interior and Interior Secretary Sally Jewell, and then the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management, which is an agency of the Department of the Interior, all the decisions on whether or not to allow oil companies to drill there really rests on them. You know, Congress doesn't really have a lot of power there at all. So what they can do, they could choose to cancel Shell's lease to drill in the Chukchi Sea, and that would be a major step forward, not only to send a message to companies like Shell that these projects can't go forward if we're to avoid catastrophic climate change, but it would also mean a lot that the 500,000 comments that were sent into that administration this year to say cancel these leases were actually listened to. So just this week, you know, the U.S. plans to submit a pledge to cut greenhouse gas emissions up to nearly 30% as part of the global treaty leading up to the Paris climate talks. So if he does that this week, that's great news. But then in the same week, to approve a company like Shell to go drill in the Arctic, which would not only lead to a devastating oil spill, but global scientists have also said we cannot burn Arctic oil if we're going to avoid the worst impacts of climate change.
So Shell has had several disastrous attempts to drill in the Arctic, and they want to try again. Are any other oil companies following their lead?
Shell is the only company that has plans to drill, has openly said that they want to drill and act on the leases they've bought. Other companies are waiting to see if they are successful. When they went to drill in 2012, it was disaster after disaster after disaster. Two of their rigs nearly ran aground. The Kulik did run aground, which is one of their rigs that they used in 2012. So they're really the only company that is acting on any of the leases. They've spent, you know, more than $6 billion so far on the Arctic drilling project with really nothing to show for it.
Cassidy Sharp, I've heard this effort to stop Arctic drilling described like the fight against the Keystone XL pipeline. You know, that if it's approved, it will be game over for the climate. Is Greenpeace part of any coalition, like came together around the Keystone XL, that's fighting Arctic drilling in various ways beyond just having your boats following Shell around in the Arctic?
Yeah, that's actually the most exciting part. And we saw this happen with Keystone, which is why Arctic drilling is really poised to become the next Keystone moment, not just from a symbolic standpoint, but from a standpoint of this project cannot go forward. And we see tons of organizations really taking this issue and prioritizing it. So just this year, for instance, Greenpeace has joined Sierra Club, Alaska Wilderness League, Oceana, Credo, Avaaz, the list goes on, to submit more than 500,000 comments to asking for the Obama administration to cancel these leases. But where we're really seeing a lot of excitement right now, too, is in Seattle, where the Port Commission of Seattle ended up signing a lease with Shell to house their Arctic drilling fleet, which we like to call the Arctic Destroyers, to stay at Terminal 5 in Seattle. So we're seeing an amazing movement in Seattle right now of tons of groups, labor groups, environmental groups, saying not only do we not want Shell's drilling fleet in Seattle, they signed a 2-year lease, we are opposed to Arctic drilling completely. Our ship, the Esperanza, in the Pacific Ocean, following Shell's drilling rig, the Polar Pioneer, which is heading north towards Seattle, and they're keeping a watch on them. They're watching their move and trailing them through the ocean, so we're working on that front. And then we're also working in Seattle, and then we're also working in D.C. with national organizations to keep up with every step of the regulatory process and taking part in comment periods and letting President Obama know that this is not something we want to see move forward.
That was Cassidy Sharp, media officer with Greenpeace USA. For more information on the campaign to stop oil drilling in the Arctic, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. In the winter of 2012, Bill McKibben, the author of a dozen books about the environment and founder of the grassroots climate change campaign group 350.org, launched a 21-city tour focused on organizing university students and faculty to pressure their institutions to divest their portfolios of fossil fuel stocks and related investments. McKibben's organizing drive was inspired by the International Anti-Apartheid Divestment Campaign of the 1980s. That was an important part of the movement that helped topple South Africa's racist government. Fast forward 2.5 years, and more than 25 colleges and dozens of cities, towns, religious denominations, and foundations in the U.S. and around the world have voted to divest from fossil fuels. The progress of the divestment campaign comes as the U.S. government continues to be blocked from taking even minimal action to address climate change
by the Republican Party, whose majority of members in Congress deny that man-made global warming constitutes a threat to the planet's environment. This spring, the Student Divestment Network has called for an escalation of actions demanding divestment on campuses nationwide. Leading the way are students at Swarthmore College in Pennsylvania, who on March 19th launched the first in the nation indefinite occupation of their college's finance and investment office. Students active in the group Swarthmore Mountain Justice are demanding that the college's board of managers enter into good faith negotiations, leading to an immediate freeze on new fossil fuel investments, followed by a staged withdrawal over 5 years and an investment of 1% of the endowment in renewable energy. Your reporter spoke with Swarthmore College student climate activists George Woodliffe Stanley and Sarah Dobbs, who talk about the goals of their group's ongoing sit-in and similar actions taking place at colleges and universities across the country.
Swarthmore Mountain Justice started in 2011. Divestment as a whole movement, as we know it in the international sphere, began at Swarthmore, actually, which is part of why it's untenable that our college has not divested when so many other venerable schools and institutions around the world have already divested. But the divestment movement started at Swarthmore. Our goals have been sustained for the past 4 years, calling on our board to divest our endowment from the fossil fuels that it's invested in. There have been a number of actions throughout the years. Over those 4 years, we've had over 30 meetings with the board of managers calling for divestment. We've had petitions, we've had rallies and marches on campus calling for divestment. Mountain Justice has been really instrumental in the international campaign for divestment, and it's led us to our current place, coordinating with other schools with their sit-ins currently, and it's spread to cities and organizations. Recently, the Rockefeller Brothers Foundation, the original oil family, divested all their money from fossil fuels. So that's the history of our campaign at Swarthmore. And we've just seen that throughout the negotiations, it hasn't led the board to move. And this past February, the director of the board, Gil Kemp, issued a statement saying that negotiations on divestment were permanently closed and the board would not reopen the issue of divestment in the foreseeable future. And that's when our campaign decided that we needed to take a bold action to tell them that they need to reopen negotiations in good faith and make some progress towards divestment, because it's really essential.
So tell our listeners about the number of students that are sitting in there at the Swarthmore Campus Finance and Investment Office demanding the reopening of negotiations on fossil fuel divestment.
Sure. We started out really strong. So this started out on 9 a.m. Thursday morning of March 19th. And it started with 37 students and 6 alumni, so a total of 43 Swarthmore Mountain Justice members sitting in the Finance and Investments office. And we've kept that number up. It's been strong. We have a sign-in sheet at our sit-in where people that come and sit for a sustained period of time sign their names. And that sign-in sheet is now past like 110 people that have signed it on. And even that is an underestimate, because there are a lot of people I know who have come by and kind of helped out and sat in for a bit who have not even signed in. So,
yeah, and we're receiving a lot of outside support, too, from community members. Alumni have dropped by and brought us food, and it's really growing the conscience of the larger community.
It's been incredible to really witness how much support we have.
What's been the reaction of the administration since you started your sit-in there at the Finance and Investment Office there on campus on March 19th? Have they threatened to evict you by force, or are they or are they tolerating your presence there?
Yeah, well, in planning any bold direct action, you plan for the worst. And fortunately, we have encountered the best so far. You know, we've had public safety, who's not police, come by, and at first we had anticipation. They're just like, hey, what's going on? And, they were really cool about it and very...
very helpful and supportive.
Yeah, amenable. Yeah. And within the first 6 hours of our sit-in, the board of managers issued a statement that they had our interim president, Connie Hungerford, read to the members of the sit-in, saying that the board would, in fact, reopen negotiations at their board meeting in May. Mm-hmm. And it was ambiguous as to what they were saying, which is why we're still sitting in, because they have our demands to reopen negotiations on divestment directly in good faith and move towards a sustainable future for Swarthmore. That has not been directly addressed, but within 6 hours, she did say that they're going to continue discussing divestment at the May board meeting.
So yeah, right off the bat, we had a big win, which was getting it on the agenda for that meeting. And we're also continuing to sit in because this is a part of a national movement, and really an international movement. I mean, it's a huge, huge thing. And a lot of other colleges and universities are really looking to us right now for kind of support and guidance and sort of the reassurance that that you know, we're still here, we're still sitting in, and they can too, and all together we will really push this issue forward. So it's sort of like we're not even just sitting in for Swarthmore, we're really sitting in on behalf of the world.
Everyone who's affected by climate change, which is, you know, as we know, disproportionately marginalized communities.
Yeah, so,
and that was one thing that environmental, like world famous environmental activist Bill McKibben spoke about at his talk at, when he came and visited us at the sit-in and to speak at Swarthmore, is that he really stressed the larger picture and reinstilled that vision for a more sustainable future for all the people who are not here with us. Like, it really is that we're fighting for. This movement is so much larger than ourselves, than any of us are as individuals, and it's really bringing people together across the country and across the world.
That was Swarthmore College students George Woodliffe Stanley and Sarah Dobbs, active in the group Swarthmore Mountain Justice, engaged in the occupation of the college's finance and investment office. Learn more about the growing international fossil fuel divestment campaign by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Leslie Rudden, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.